the Torah wants to give us three different visions of man. How Hashem do it? Did Hashem do it by Perek Aleph or Perek Beis? We don't know. And he says, in truth, we don't have to know. We're not clear. The Torah's purpose in Parshas Bereishis, as you mentioned last week, is not to teach me the sequence of creation, but to teach me moral truths about my life. I look at the Torah and I look about how I am supposed to live. And the Torah is much more a description of how human beings live, or should live, how Jews should live, rather than describing how the Ribono Shel Olam actually lives. We say anyone who aces in his Torah, we don't necessarily have to understand that in his hidden hand and concealed. And therefore he says the following. He says that the two word pictures, Paragon and Paraphrase, represent two dimensions of man, or human being, which he calls Adam 1 and Adam 2. Not that, remember, that doesn't mean that there were two Adams, there's only one Adam Harishon, but rather you see two facets of the personality of the human being as it emerges from Paragon and Paraphrase. Well, yes. In other words, Perek Aleph just talks about the human being being created in the image of Hashem. It doesn't say how at all. Perek Bey talks about God after being created in the dust of the earth and the mud, making the mud statuettes. So he calls, just to use his language, he calls Adam 1 majestic man, and he calls Adam 2 redemptive man. He can explain what he means by these titles. He says that the thrust of Perek Aleph is to stress the greatness and grandeur of the human being, the kochos that a human being has. The fact that a human being, and again, keep in mind too, that the Musar and the ethics that we get from Perek Aleph are not limited to the Jewish people, because Adam is the founder, as it were, of all human beings. And the concept is that a human being is not supposed to be victimized by the brute forces of nature. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu put us on the world to be partners with the Ribono Shel Olam in being the stock of the world. This is true, of course, in the moral sense, in the learning of Torah, doing the mitzvahs, but even in the technological sense, to conquer disease. For example, it's never been the Jewish attitude. You know, Christian scientists say that if all sickness comes from God, it's an interference with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to seek medical intervention. Now, I think it sounds like a pretty good theological argument. How do we overcome that argument? Like, it's going to be correct to seek medical attention. We say that any wisdom and skill that human beings have comes from Hashem as well. In other words, to say that what I do interferes with the Ribono Shel Olam seems to be positing a dichotomy between the natural, which is godly, and the human, which is non-godly. But we recognize, of course, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's ratzon that human beings would have the wisdom and the ability to discover the polio vaccine in the 1950s. And for whatever reason, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted that to be used in the 1950s. Why wasn't it discovered before? Why were their children die of polio? Now, we don't know why Hashem chooses to allow certain things to be discovered at certain times, but it's never been the tradition of the Yid that there's a notion of interference. We don't even, for example, in reproductive technology. You can read Catholic analysis about in vitro fertilization and things like that. C.A. Dufresne, who says, you can't do those things because that's not the natural way. Somehow the natural way is the right way, and what humans come up with is not the natural way. Now, there are many shilas in these areas. I don't mean to say there are many shilas, but you will not hear a posek say, you're not allowed to do something because it's not the natural way. And that is not a rhetoric, because we believe the chokhmah that a human being has also comes from the Ribono Shel Olam. Yeah, there might be other shilas, of course, but there's no issue that it's only the natural way that's proper, and the unnatural way is not proper, because the unnatural also comes from the Ribono Shel Olam. So the message of Perek Aleph is the fact that the human being is supposed to be a shutef with Hashem. In other words, in a sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu left the world in a state of some imperfection, because he wanted the human being, the fellow of the human, the image of God, to be an active partner in the creation of the world. The first says, that is the name of the Pasuk, Asher Bara Elohim Ma'asos. At the end of creation, says, V'yivarech Elohim Asher Mashi Hashem blessed the seventh day, the Kadesh Oso, and he sanctified the day, Ki lo shavas mikol malachta, because on the seventh day, he rested from all of his malacha, all of his work, Asher Bara Elohim, that Hashem created, La'asos, to do. That doesn't really fit in. He created it. The answer is, he created it with a certain sense of imperfection. La'asos, so that we should continue that work. This is very first us. In fact, the whole rabbi of Bris Mila is that way. The Medrash quotes somebody asked Rabbi Akiva, the Roman asked Rabbi Akiva, Hashem wanted the Jewish male to be circumcised. Why did he create them circumcised? Why did he create them imperfect, incomplete, defective? The answer is that if Hashem wants the human being, it's a remnant. If Hashem wants the human being to take that which is left in a certain state of imperfection and go on. That's why the name of Hashem that is used for Bris Mila is very significant. It is Shakai, Shem Dalet. And what is the name Shakai? Because the name is always translated as the Almighty. But we know the Medrash tells us that Shakai is an acronym for She'amar La'olam Odai. Odai, and it was Hashem said enough. What does it mean Hashem said enough? So the Medrash explains that when Hashem initiated the creative process, logically creation would have kept on going. In other words, the concept would be that the wheat would turn into the seeds, and the seeds would turn into the flour, and the flour would turn into the bread. Creation would keep on going till it reached its final stage. HaKadosh Baruch Hu at one point, however, said, "Die, it is enough. I want the creation of the world to stop and remain in a state of some degree of incompletion." In other words, the wheat you have to grind up and everything else, because I want Adam to make sure. So this is what is called the majesty of man, the ability of a human being to be a co-creator with Ribono Shel Olam. This is true in science, this is true in technology, this is true in ruchnius, where through our mitzvahs we bring kedusha into the world. When a person learns Torah, and a person has insight and thought and chiddush in Torah, and that is also the word creating Torah with Ribono Shel Olam. Yeah, that's a difficult idea actually, because people say, well, is there such a thing as creating Torah? We say everything is given to Moshe to Sinai. So what role is there for creation of Torah? But the truth is that when we say everything was given to Moshe to Sinai, even any word that a person says, that's true. That doesn't mean that Moshe Rabbeinu heard every possible word in the Torah. But rather it means just as the seed or the acorn contains within it the potentiality of the oak that grows later. So basically, the data and the information that Moshe Rabbeinu received contains within it all the conclusions that we derive later. So, for example, Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't necessarily given a pshat about a microwave oven on Shabbos. But the pshat is that when we take the klalim and we apply it to a microwave, we are in effect using the Torah that Moshe was given to see myself. In effect, it is possible to create Torah by building on the insight that was given and deriving its implications and applying it to new situations. So all of this is Perek Aleph. That stresses the majesty, the godless Adam. Now this explains four of our discrepancies. This is why the name of Hashem that is used in Perek Aleph is only Elohim. Now Elohim is a very strange name of Hashem, because Elohim, because we don't pronounce it Elohim when it refers to that, is not limited to the divine. The word Elohim can be used to refer to judges. It can be used to refer to a power, right? Etc. Like it says in the second commandment, Lo yi elecha Elohim acherim al panai, you shall not have any other Elohim. That's not just saying idols, that's saying look at the other forces of the world, which are forces of the world, and don't regard them as having any superior authority. So, therefore, Elohim is the name of God which can share a common bond between God and man. We can also be. In fact, if you remember, what did Avraham Mechavis actually, the Nachash told him this, but to some degree the Nachash was correct. The Nachash says, if you eat from the fruit of the Eitz Hadas, you will be godly, Yodei Tovah. Now the Nachash was not lying, because in fact the human being does have what we would call an Elohim capacity. That is the capacity to control nature, to be a co-creator with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The only evil of eating of the Eitz Hadas is HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not want the evil, which is the component of choice. Choice means the desire towards the evil. He does not want that to be incorporated within the human being. As you know what the Bali Musher says, the Bali Musher explained that the chait of the Eitz Hadas was that Adam and Chava felt that the shame shamayim they felt, that the goal of the human being is to be a chooser. And the goal of the human being is to struggle. So Chava and Adam actually felt it would be a mitzvah to eat from the Eitz Hadas, incorporate the passion for evil within them, and then they would have to struggle. That's dramatic. In other words, it was an Abeira, the shame shamayim. In other words, they felt that, gee, if the goal of life is to struggle against evil, if we don't have the evil, how are we going to struggle? I cannot explain, they try to explain, this explains the circular question that everybody asks, and that is, if Adam and Chava did not have the choice to be good or evil until they ate from the Eitz Hadas, so by what means did the Nachash tempt Chava to eat from the Eitz Hadas? And Chava tempted Adam to eat from the Eitz Hadas. Where was the struggle? So they say, well, the struggle was a mistake in judgment. That human being is always that, even before the faith. Was possible in a person's chase for spirituality to make the wrong judgment call. And ultimately, it may have come from a good place, but it disregarded Hashem's people. Now again, people sometimes think, well, that's ludicrous. Hashem told you not to eat. How do you make a test from Hashem Shemayim that it's better to eat? I mean, that's a ludicrous thing. On what basis could other Mechavim think they were correct?
There was a
level of fear, that's right. People still have to choose the best way to serve Hashem. But the truth of the matter is, we make this mistake all the time, because we always try to second guess. We go to Shalom. We're put in certain situations, and we constantly say, well, if we do this way, then I would serve Hashem properly. If we do that way, I serve Hashem properly. My condition would be different. That would be the optimal. And yet, the Rebbe Shalom doesn't always give us that condition. He gave us some other condition. Meaning, Hashem is telling you, this is the situation in which you can serve the best. So, the notion of second-guessing has a long history in the human race, going back to other Muhammad. But it's something that we do very, very often. We don't make peace with the matzah. Just create, in a way, I'm contradicting myself. Because, on one hand, I'm saying the theme of Perek Aleph is that the human being has to be a co-creator with Hashem. In other words, recognizing the imperfection of the world and trying to change them, to combat disease, right, to build cities, to dam up the torrential floods, to create Torah, to create Kedusha. In other words, the Torah is rejecting here what we would call passivity, or you use a fancier word, quiescence, which just means blindly accepting what life is. However, we also know there does come a point in life where we recognize that certain things are not going to be able to change. Therefore, I have to make shalom in that situation. What is the famous alcoholic's prayer? Change things I can't change, and the serenity, or the power, I don't remember exactly, but the serenity to accept that which I can't, and the wisdom to know the difference. And that's a tremendous chokhmah in life. To recognize that a human being has a responsibility to change and to grow and to try to improve, but to also recognize that there are times in which the mode is going to be one of the exceptions. In Pirkei Avos says, a Zehu Ashir, Asameach Bechelko, a wealthy person is a person who rejoices in their lot. Now most of us understand this to refer to Gashmias, and in the material world certainly, one should be some man with Delta, that's obvious. One shouldn't, you know, we want to have more money, unless, you know, more cars, whatever it is, but you accept it's what you have. But in Ruchnius, many people say, or even in some man with Delta, you always have to try to be more. And that, of course, is true, but the Sfarim tell us there is a getter, there is a definition of Sameach B'chelko is Lechinis as well. And that is, although you try to grow and improve, but you look at what you have and you say, within this framework is how I can serve Hashem the best. And not looking to others, not looking at what other people do, but trying to cultivate one's own unique relationship with that place. So hopefully get there some help. Because so much of the time, we look at others, or we just say, well, if only I had this, if only I was this, if only I was in this place, then I could serve Hashem properly. Even Sameach B'chelko says to recognize that where we are can also be a good place.
So how does this work?
Well, certainly a person has to strive. The concept is there's a striving within a framework. You know, some of the concepts are when will I be like the portal of the other? When will I take whatever I have and serve Hashem properly? It doesn't mean when will I be an Abraham, but it means when will I be like an Abraham to use all of this power to serve Hashem. In other words, the percentage is based on what you have. If I'm a smaller vessel, then I want to be 100% of that. Actually, there's a word from Zusha. Zusha once said, yeah, the famous Zusha that everybody knows. He's the one that said, Hashem is not going to ask me, why wasn't I Avram, etc. Why wasn't I Zusha? That's the famous statement of Rav Zusha. Why wasn't I what I was, or what I could have been? But there's another statement that Rav Zusha said.
Now, because I was just going to add that I heard from Rav Shaga Silverstein many years ago, a sailor knows he'll never reach the stars. He only uses them to steer by. And it was just a very...
That's very nice. Yeah. If you don't look at the stars, you get lost. The other thing this is less known, but it's also an interesting remark. He once said, if the Ribbono Shel Olam would offer me the chance to change places with Avraham Avinu, he says, I wouldn't accept it. Because what would Hashem get out of the bargain? There would still be one Avraham and one Zusha. What's the gain for this? I mean, good, I get the ego, whatever it is, but what's the gain? Because Baruch gets no Tohelis. Simply trading one person for another person. Then on the other hand, apparently there's a need for a Zusha in the world because he created one. So, but the point is, going back to the main idea, that Perek Aleph stresses the majesty and godliness of Adam, and we see this in the four particulars. The name Elohim is used, which is the common link between man and God as co-creators of the world. The simultaneous creation of man and woman is emphasized. Because in truth, in order for human beings to create in the world, both in terms of creating life and in terms of creating society, there needs to be that social interaction and family unit. In other words, the human being in a state of isolation could not do this. So if Perek Aleph is stressing the potentialities of the human being to create a world and build up a society, it presupposes the social relationship, which is the only possible way that that can be done. It makes no mention, coming to the third point, of Afor, of the human being being dust, because the theme of Perek Aleph is the majesty and grandeur of the human being. And that's why it stresses the Tzelem Elohim, the image of God, which is one of creativity, one of choice, one of mastery, one of power. And finally, the mission that Adam is given in Perek Aleph is one of domination and control. But that's stressing these similarities that man has with Ribbono Shel Olam. Again, of course the similarities are infinitely removed, but there is a similarity. The Torah itself is made with the Tzelem Elohim. Now, the Salvechik Ben Modanit says, if all you have, though, is the image of Adam that emerges from Perek Aleph, that creates a tremendous danger. That is the danger of arrogance. That is the danger of gaiva. That is the danger of what the Torah calls in the Book of Devarim, Kochi v'yaitzim yati, asoliya zachayo hazeh. My power, my might, has created everything. That was the sin, of course, of the Dor HaFlada, the power of Babel. What was the reaction? It's very mysterious. What exactly was the sin of the Dor HaFlada? But according to the way what emerges from most proportion, was a sense that they were so impressed with their technological requirements, with their knowledge, with their power, that they thought they could literally just replace the Ribbono Shel Olam. It happens a lot, even in family businesses sometimes. right? You see your partner brings in the junior partner, and the junior partner then figures that they get rid of the old person that was the boss. And of course, Chas v'Shalom, the person can have that same attitude here. And therefore, the Perek, which describes the majesty of man, needs to be counterbalanced with an alternative creation account in chapter 2, which discusses the submissiveness of man, the fallibility of the human being, the weakness, the helplessness of the human being. And thus, look at the differences. In Perek Beis, the name of Hashem that is introduced for the first time is also the Shem Havayah, the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei. And the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei is the transcendence, intrinsic name of God that can never be used, you don't even pronounce it, it can never be used for anyone except the Ribono Shel Olam. It represents the utter transcendence that we have no connection to Hashem in the sense of comparing ourselves. It talks about the weakness of the human being as a lonely creature, an isolated creature, a helpless creature who had no companionship and had a gaping void in his life that can only be filled by turning to Hashem and Hashem filling that loneliness. It talks about the human being not as Selam Elohim, but it talks about the human being as Afar Min Ha'adamah, thus, and to dust we return. And finally, the mission is not one of creation and domination, but it's one of preserving the Bria of Hashem. And this is how the human being acquires, what is it, the word redemption. And therefore, the concept is, if all you have is Perek Aleph, Adam 1, you have arrogance, and Zaiba, and eventually heresy. If all you have is Perek Beis, you have passivity and despair, because you leave everything to the Ribono Shel Olam. It is only the combination of Perek Aleph and Perek Beis that gives us the energy and optimism to go out and create, but also to recognize that ultimately, all of our Hatzlacha depends on our submission as to Ribono Shel Olam. So which way did Hashem actually do it? We have no idea. And that's not what the Torah is trying to tell me. But the Torah is painting two different pictures, like a 3D thing. We put on the 3D glasses, so you see two different images, but they get molded together by the eyes. So as a result, it is the composite of the two prophets that give us a vision of the human being. In fact, if you even say further, just to take this a little further, this might be the connection between a Shalom Zachar and a Bris. The two great symbols are Shabbos and Bris Milah, both of which are called an oath. We know that the first, I think, Machlokes, Mechagim, we know that the Shabbos before a Bris, after a boy is born, you know, you have a Shalom Zachar. Actually, there's a Machlokes, actually. You have it the first Friday night after birth, or the Friday night before the Bris. Now, normally they'll be the same, but if the Bris is delayed, do you delay the Shalom Zachor or not? There are two different minhagim. And there are two makoros why we have a Shalom Zachor. One I'm sure you've heard, if you've ever put out chickpeas, you know the explanation. That is before...
No,
I'll
just put out
the chickpeas. No, you'll get the explanation. Okay. All right, you're just putting out the chickpeas. But okay. Actually, it's interesting. Chickpeas, I was just reading about all the gemachs in Eretz Israel. We actually have a gemach. The makor of chickpeas is this. We know that when the child is in the mother's womb, the child learns the whole Torah. The malach teaches the whole child's Torah. And when the child is born, the malach hits the child. And that's the indication on the lip. And all of the Torah is forgotten. And the child, apparently, has a memory of once knowing the Torah and learning with the Melech. And how does he know? And the child is in a state of mourning, abeilus. And therefore, the Shalom Zachor is a seuda to be menachem, to comfort the mourner with the Melech. And just as we know in a Shiva house, now mourners eat mountains, eggs, chickpeas as well, because that represents the Dalal, that represents the Nechama, that life is a circle, and the bad things turn around and turn into good things. So it's Nicham Aveinu. According to that, by the way, therefore, it is important that the child should be present at the Shalom Zachar. It's a Nicham Aveinu. And that's why, theoretically, I don't know, if the mother and baby are still in the hospital, or is that the shell doctor should actually be in the hospital?
At least,
this is very interesting. The issue is, what about women, etc.? That's a problem. Women also have the implications. Even Goyim do, right? So what do Goyim say? So some say, well, Goyim learned the seven mitzvahs of Noah. Okay. Women could also learn the whole Torah. Let me explain why this would be so. What's the purpose of learning the whole Torah if you don't forget? What's the purpose, right? What is the whole purpose of that exercise? And then forget it. The answer would be, all of us know that if you learn something once, you totally forget it. Mm-hmm. When you're exposed to it again, number one, it's easier to learn, and there's a certain recognition. Gee, this is something I've seen before. And that creates a receptivity to absorbing. You learn how to ride a bicycle or whatever, if you speak French, whatever. Various talents we've picked up that we may have totally forgotten, but nevertheless, there is a certain element that this is familiar and I can relearn it. And therefore, the concept is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to create in the neshama a receptivity to the words of Torah so they penetrate. And therefore, that initial exposure, even if you forget all the knowledge, creates a receptivity in the neshama for words of Torah. Now, therefore, the concept is to create a receptivity to words of Torah. The emphasis, I think, is every reason to assume that women have gone through the same experience. And the reason why, perhaps, we're not the Nachamado is the following. Women don't have a technical obligation to know Torah, but they do have an obligation to internalize the values and mitzvos that the Torah teaches. So the fact that a woman may have, the baby may have forgotten the Torah knowledge, is not necessarily a cause for sadness, because they may have forgotten the knowledge, but they've absorbed the receptivity. It is the man that has the technical obligation of retaining the knowledge as well, where there's a certain sense of mourning. So, again, that's just a thought of that now, so I'm not sure if I have any recognition. It's a possible explanation. But I would think, though, that in terms of the Lumen HaTorah, I would assume that women do learn the Torah before they're born as well. If together is the receptivity. And of course, why does Hashem take it away? Because Hashem says, the Yikar in life is not what I give you. The Yikar in life, again, is the co-creator idea to do it on your own. I've given you the receptivity, I take it away, and now regain it on your
own.
Oh, okay. Now that's the second. Okay. Now you're correct. That first reason wouldn't be connected with Shabbos per se. Now, the second reason for Shalom Zachar is the following. Shabbos is called the Matronisa of Hashem. Shabbos is called the Princess of Hashem. Again, it's very interesting that Shabbos is almost has two husbands, in a sense, because some Midrashim talk about the Kala of Shabbos, and then Yisrael are the Zivug of Shabbos. Other Midrashim talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu being the Zivug of Shabbos. So this Midrash talks about Shabbos as being the Matronisa, the matron, the princess of God. And Bris Milah is when we encounter Hashem by covenant. So the Midrash says, Hashem says to the child, before you meet me, you have to get along with my princess, with my wife, Shabbos. Before you have a Bris Milah, before the child is Mekabel, the Shechina, you have to spend time with the Matronisa, which is Shabbos, which is why it's connected to Shabbos. But what's the getter? So it could very well be that if you think about Shabbos, you know, everyone knows the famous Pshat of Rav Hirsch, which is the definitive explanation of Malacha, that the concept of Malacha, which we translate as don't do work, work is a totally inaccurate. The word is Avodah, actually, not Malacha, because many things are Shabbos. You're allowed to do many things that are hard work on Shabbos, right? It's not malacha. Within a house, within an enclosed area, you can carry tables and schlep them, and yet if you walk outside without an erev and there's a little toothpick in your pocket, you transgress the malacha. Right? So malacha has nothing to do with work. Moreover, in Hilchos Shabbos, we have a certain anomaly that if you blow up a building, you destroy a building. Right? The malacha of destruction is only if you destroy for the purpose of rebuilding. This is the lesson stuff. I need to work these things out. But in terms of the Torah, a purely destructive act is permitted to be done on Shabbos. And look at it. Korea, working is only forbidden. Doraisa, that is, of course, if it's with the intention of re-sowing. In other words, kerosene, in order to sow it more evenly. Soser, destroying a building, min ha-Torah, is forbidden only if it's with the condition of rebuilding. Mochek, erasing letters, is only a malacha if it's almanas lichto, if it's for the purpose of writing. In other words, purely destructive acts are not malacha. So raisa. So again, what does that do with work? Obviously the work is very much there. Interestingly enough, just as a digression, now the Gemara makes the point psychologically that certain destructive acts might in fact serve constructive purposes. The Gemara makes the point that if somebody smashes something because they're angry, that is treated as a malacha because they remove their anger. Although it's forbidden to do that generally, even very briefly. But there is a concept of relief of anger might be a constructive purpose as well. But generally, as I mentioned, Mar specifically says anyone who breaks something because they're angry is like they're an idol worshiper. But the first points out, if malacha doesn't mean work, and the proof is because you can do things in the house that are very difficult, but are not work, that are not malachas, and conversely, destructive acts are also not malachas, even though they're very difficult. So he says malacha is not work. But malacha is a demonstration of man's creative abilities by transforming nature. Right? So all of the malachas involve the transformation of raw materials into something new. That's writing, starting a fire, cooking, harvesting, threshing. All malachas involve the mastery of the human being over the raw materials of the world by creative processes. The only one that you might say does not involve creative transformation is carry. You might say, well, if I just schlep something from point A to point B, from my house into the outside, what creative transformation of the entity has occurred? Well, you're right. That's why Tosfos says in the Second Shabbos that Hotzah is carrying, is called a Malach of Ruh. It's an inferior Malach, meaning he just made the list. In other words, theoretically, it almost didn't get on the list because you don't have that transformation. Nevertheless, we say that since objects, an object is related to its time and its place, so moving the object into a different place could be regarded as a weak form of transformation. In other words, the object here is not the same as the object there, and therefore, in a sense, its relationship to the world spatially has been altered. But there is an opinion in the Gemara that indeed says carrying is not one of the 39 malachas. It's not clear if he only has 38 or he has another one, which we don't know what it is, but there is a das yachid that says that. So the first makes the point, therefore, that malacha is not so much exertion. Malacha is the demonstration of creativity. Which is why, as Gleason said, which is why when people say, well, in the olden days you couldn't start a fire, which was forbidden because you had to rub two sticks together and everything else, was very hard, and today it's so easy with a mask, so of course it's permitted. What happened? The easier it gets, perhaps the more usher it is, because that shows our creativity even to a greater degree.
But we're talking mainly about the physical world, because as far as learning goes,
yes, that's physical.
That's
a very good point. It's man's creativity in the physical world. And even then, you know, one can create human life on Shabbos. So you're correct. It's limited in that context.
I was just thinking about creativity. So that means like if you, you're not allowed to, let's say you have vegetables and you want to serve a platter and you want to make roses out of radishes. I mean, you'd have to do it the day before, right?
Generally speaking, that's correct.
So you can't really do any of that stuff, like cutting in a fancy way or...
Well, fancy needs to be defined. You're allowed to cut vegetables on Shabbos, but remember, one of the malachas of Shabbos is grinding, that's chopping things up into very small pieces. So when you cut vegetables for Shabbos, you should do so right before the meal, and the pieces should be slightly larger than you normally do, and you should not cut them into images or pictures or special shapes like that. That should be before. foreshadows.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct. Those are different malachas. And again, it's interesting. Cutting something into tiny pieces is a malacha called tochen, that's grounding. Making images is actually considered kosei, considered writing, because creating pictures is a form of writing. Okay, but be it as it may, if the concept of malacha is creativity, then Shabbos is a time when God commands us to cease from our creative mastery over the physical world, to acknowledge that Hashem is the source of creation. In effect, therefore, Shabbos corresponds to chapter 2, to Adam 2. Shabbos corresponds to the notion of passivity. Now, again, I admit this is a little problematical because Shabbos was written at the end of Perek Aleph, but maybe that's because Shabbos is the necessary corrective to the majesty of man that emerges. In other words, the concept is, if Perek Aleph stresses the majesty of man, the greatness of man, the potential of man, I say man, you know, man-woman, which can lead to arrogance and conceit, Shabbos is the great corrective to that. And that's why Shabbos is put right after that first account of Adam B'Tselem Elohim, to remember, you're B'Tselem Elohim, but you're not Elohim, you're not God. You have the image of God, you have similarities, you have points of contact, you have commonality, you are charged with a certain mission that is God-like, but you're not God, and once a week you have to remember that. But if you look at the Bris Milah, Bris Milah is the opposite. Bris Milah is Adam 1. Because Bris Milah, as I said before, is the symbol of God leaving the world in a state of imperfection so that we perfect. And therefore, what we're telling our child is this. We want our child to be creative, that is, sets of their abilities, of their talents, of their kochos. But before we give a Bris Milah, we have to experience they have to internalize. Again, is the child absorbing this on an unconscious level, and ain't they old child? We don't know, but at least it's a symbolic lesson for the parents that one has to experience the meaning of Shabbos, and then one can go on. This is working with Yisrael Zonenfeld, so it reminds me of this. If you look at the Shabbos songs, I would say it every day, Ein Kelo Kenyo. There's none like our God, etc. So the question is, it's like Jeopardy. It first gives you the answer, then it gives you the question. It says, Ein Kelokeinu, then it says, Mi Kelokeinu, who is like your God? Maybe it should have said, Mi Kelokeinu. So this is what Zonenfeld said. It's okay to ask all the questions you want, as long as you're sure of the answer ahead of time. Meaning to say that it's only after a person has emunah that then you try to investigate logically, you know, what is God. In other words, there is a mitzvah to try to understand Hashem to whatever degree we can. In other words, there is a mitzvah to ask questions and to challenge and to doubt, but that comes after one has that emunah. And you have that emunah, and that's not going to be shaken no matter what. Then there's a mitzvah of yudias Hashem. Try to understand and try to ask. But you have to have the emunah first. Otherwise, we'll be led astray. So the similar idea here is that there's a mitzvah of the human being to emulate Hashem, to regard themselves as godlike, but only after the sort of faith in Hashem and submission has been deeply imagined. So these are the two accounts. This is the connection between Shalom Zachar and Bris Milah. We can go further, even by conversion, for example, we see the connection of going to the mikveh and Bris Milah. Because going to the mikveh is also total submission to God. And you might want one goes to mikvah. One goes to the total submission because mikvah in itself is a symbolic death and rebirth. It's death, go under the water. And that person takes to live that life. And then it's a reemergence from the womb. Now that represents the total submission to our Kaddish Baruch Hu. This new represents the other partnership.
When you
talk
about people,
there's
one perfect. Someone who is in the Well, that's the question. Again, there are a lot of questions. I mean, some of this refers to what Hashem knows is going to happen. And some of it refers to the fact that other Marishim, in other words, what would have been, let's assume there wouldn't have been a Chais, what would other Marishim's goal have been in the world? That is, he lives in a perfect world. It's pretty boring. I mean, what would it be for other Marishim to do? So apparently there would have been, after all, what does Hashem tell other Marishim? Tell the other Marishim that your job in the Garden of Eden is li'avda, to cultivate the garden, ulashamra, and to protect the garden. The question is, what do you cultivate it for, what, and to protect it from what? Right? So, although we don't fully understand, but apparently, the concept of shakad, the amar li olam odai, that God did leave things incomplete, existed even in Gan Eden, there must have been an avodah. Okay? Now, I don't know exactly what that was, but it's very, very clear there was something left for Adam to do. But you know the Medrash says that if Adam would have just waited, the Medrash says, if Adam would have waited until Shabbos, the Eitz Hadas would have been committed for him. As Hashem told Adam and Chava, you can't eat from this tree. Now remember, Adam was created very late on Friday. Adam was created late Friday afternoon. Yeah, that's right. Now, Adam didn't know. Probably Adam didn't know. Adam knew maybe he could have waited. He didn't know. But if Adam could have held out, Adam and Chava held out until Shabbos, it would have been much better. But again, maybe that's the concept. The concept is that it's okay for a human being to become godlike in their capacity to choose if they've absorbed the message of Shabbos. They haven't absorbed the message. Then they can't make that step. And it could be, again, the same connection with the Shalom Truck around the family and the grist. So it's a difficult balance. It's a balance, really. It's a very practical question. It's a question that involves the way we raise our children, etc. And it goes back to the idea that a person has to think Anochi Yoko Vieper and Dust the Ashes and this really irrelevant because of who the world was created. That balance of a person being mature, their ability. It comes up a lot in the process of tshuva. How much do I spend focusing on my chesronos? It's a beautiful word, by the way, from the Sfas Emes. We're not really near Hanukkah yet, but we're close enough. I'm writing word about Hanukkah. You know the argument between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. It's a famous argument. You commemorate Hanukkah by lighting 8 candles and going down. That's what Beis Shammai says. Start off with 8, and you go down. And Beis Hillel, which is of course what we do, we add every day. So it's difficult to understand Beis Shammai. Like, what would be the concept of starting with 8 and then going down? So the Sfas Emes says that the candles are a remez to the neshama of a person. You know that the candles are the neshama, right? You can light the Yartzeit candle, plus it says the Mishnah is Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam. The soul of a human being is a Ner. The soul of a human being is a candle from Hashem, that Hashem lights. So he says that fire has 2 symbols. Fire is that which can destroy, and fire destroys, it consumes, and fire illuminates, gives lights. So the question is, which use of fire are we looking at? Beis Shammai says that Hanukkah represents the struggle of a human being against the forces of evil in their soul. Therefore, the fire is that passion which eradicates the negative in life. So consequently, Beis Shammai says, the sign of your progress is there should be fewer and fewer negatives to destroy it. You go along. First day, you got to attack 8 targets. And if you do a little, if you're successful, next day, 7 targets. You're focusing relentlessly on the negativity that one has to conquer. And eventually, you get it, you get it, you get it, you get it. So you're getting better. Beis Hillel times, that is not a good approach for most people, because if you focus on the chisaret kind of person, one's likely to be led astray and get depressed, and therefore the soul ever says, don't concentrate on what you're getting rid of, what you're attacking. Concentrate on the goodness that you're doing, and look at the light that you're shedding. And as a result, you become closer to Hashem that way. And the way you attack the evil is not by attacking the evil directly, but by working on good. And the good drives away the evil, just like light drives away darkness. So you have these 2 drachim, in which one stresses one's weakness and one stresses one's godless. And again, there's three different approaches between them over and over again. Throughout Klal Yisrael, we've had different teachers in different schools of Chinuch that we stress these different elements. The Musar school, we talked about business and concern, others we talked about business versus business. But this is Soloveitchik's famous thoughts about Adam 1 and Adam 2. And of course, this gets into a political issue as well, whether the mitzvah to be a scientist. Without getting into the controversial issues of the schools of thought called Torah Umata or Torah in Derech Eretz, you can readily see that the proponents of involvement in the secular culture even do base some of this on the reading of Adam 1 as being a co-partner with Hashem in the creation of nature and control of nature. Of course, one could say the same word, just say that we're a co-partner with Hashem through Yochanan's Torah. In other words, it doesn't commit you to a particular way of being a co-partner with Hashem. But this is one of the main ideological and theological bases for this particular approach.
As you probably know, there's never a totally satisfactory way of resolving these issues, because there's always going to be, boys don't give birth to babies. And in other words, there is in the world differences. And perhaps it is connected to the fact that a woman's biological essence tells her that she is a co-creator with the metaphorical nurturance of life. And you could look at the capacity of children as a substitute for at least a similar symbol to what Bris Mueller represents. And people could raise the question that way. Certain great tzaddikim were born circumcised. Shay ben Noach is said to have been born mahal. Yaakov Avinu was born mahal. That's why it doesn't record, right? We know Yitzchak and Avram had a bris. It doesn't say Yaakov had a bris. He might do well. Of course he had a bris, but Chazal say Yaakov Avinu was born mahal. Binyamin, the son of Yaakov, who it is said was a tzaddik gomor, Binyamin had no avarice at all, was born mahal. Moshe Rabbeinu was born mahal. So you do see that if one is born without the need for circumcision, that highlights a certain perfection of their character. On the other hand, it may undermine the point of Mila as showing, you're a creative partner with Hashem. But nevertheless, if nolad mahal is a good thing, then in that sense, women might be an indicative of a rather than a lack of something.
I never heard about that before. I mean, does that happen today, that boys are born that way?
Occasionally. It is rare. I don't know if you call it nice because it happens, but it's a fairly rare disease phenomenon. But it does happen. It doesn't do that. Yeah. Now, the halacha we prosecute, if a child is born mahal, he does have to have what is called a toughest operation to let out a little blood trap, just like that fish. The way he converts after he's been circumcised, not for conversion, you have to do that as well. That's only rabbinic under Torah law. If he's mahal, he's mahal. There's no need to have to go any further. Okay, let me just share with you one final thought, though. That is, we move from Parshas Bereishis into Parshas Noach, and we talked about the flood and the destruction of the world, and everything else. We'll spend much more time, but I'm going to share with you an amazing thought that I saw just for the first time. It's a little complicated, but you can write it. I said it in Shul Shabbos, and I know people, you really need a blackboard here. You have a paper, that's okay. Somebody asked the Baal Shem Tov if there was any mystical significance to the dimensions of the Teva.
How big is the table again? To remind you, it is 300 amos in length. It is 50 amos wide. It is 30 amos high, and it narrows on top to the width of an amos. It's only one amos at the very top. We have a skylight or a window. So the Baal Shem Tov told his questioner, who was also a great you told me. So this questioner came up with an amazing thought, a very short quote. He says the following, that the forces of evil in the world are represented by two. We talk about the Satan, which is really the evil inclination within a person, the Satan. I mean the Nachash, which represents that which introduced evil within us, the Nachash, which is Nun Ches Shin, and the angel of the Satan. The Satan's real name, see, Satan is not a proper noun. Satan is not Satan with a capital S. Satan means the accuser. In fact, it's a lowercase. Satan's name is Samael, which is Samach Mem Aleph Lamed Samael. So if you take Nachash and Samael, so the Ari writes the following. If you take the word Nachash, the real evil of the Nachash is in the letter Ches, because that's Chet, sin. Nun and Shin spell Shei, which is tooth. And just like a tooth, hold back the tongue, like Rosh Hashanah, we say your teeth are there to hold back your tongue. So too, Shin and Nun represent the powers of restraint in the world that prevent evil from exploding and going without the wolves. See, make sense? Now, let's take Nachash. In other words, in Nachash, Nun, Ches, Shin, the unbridled evil is the Ches, which is Chet. The Nun and the Shin, which spell Shein, Shein Nun, represent the containment of evil. Now the containment can be because people have a guilty conscience, or it could be because of peer pressure, or it could be because of a belief in God somehow, but evil generally has something which contains it, which limits it. People don't go all the way. Even if you take, the Holocaust certainly seems to go all the way. There were certain things Hitler didn't do at certain times because there was some restraint. You don't have an evil without a gevul at all. Similarly, Samael, the Samach Mem, which spells Sam, which is translated here as poison, that represents the total evil. The Aleph Lamed, which is God's name, represents the constraint and the limitation of evil. Now, if you take out the restraining letters, take out the Nun and the Shin of Nachash, you have a Ches. Take away the Aleph and Lamed from Samoel, you have Samach and Mem. Ches, Samach, Mem. Just rearrange it. Ches, Mem, Samach spells the word Chamas. Hamas is the word the Torah uses. Hamas means violence or evil or robbery. That's the word the Torah uses to describe the evil of the Dor HaMabul. It was a Hamas. It was an evil that had no principle of restraint. It was the Nachash and the Samael minus the Shin and the Nun and minus the Ches, minus the Aleph and the Lamed. And whatever goodness could restrain evil was concretized into the dimensions of the Teva. How is this? Because your two letters are, what did you take out of Nachash? Nun and Shin. Shin is 300. That's the length of the R, of the Teva. The Nun is 50, which is the width of the Teva. Lamed is 30, which is the height of the Teva. And the Aleph, which is the one Aleph. The concept is all of the restraint in the world found its way in the table of kind of dimension. So that's a remnant.
How does this person ask the question?
We know all this.
Yeah,
it's for asking the question.
So nobody is beyond redemption. Well, in the Dor HaMabul, apparently, the goodness was withdrawn,
right.
But in the world that we live in fact, the Mefarshim say the Keshet, the rainbow, and we'll discuss more about this. You know, the rainbow, the simple meaning is, it's an inverted bow, it's a bow going the other direction, So Hashem is saying, I will not destroy the world. Of course, you know, by the way, that the Keshes is a very equivocal sin. On one hand, it decides that God will not destroy the world, but it does say, it does imply that if God had a choice in the matter, he would like to. In other words, we are found that when there are great tzaddikim in a generation, one of the signs they are great tzaddikim is there was no rainbow visible in their lifetime. But someone say that that's a sign that Hashem is happy with the world. But the concept is this. Someone say that the symbol of the Keshes is the half circle. Meaning, God has withdrawn from the human being the ability to go full circle. Full circle means the ability to do an evil with beyond redemption. And the half means we can do tremendous damage in the world, but Hashem will not let us go all the way. That has interesting implications regarding nuclear wars. It's not entirely clear. And if Hashem Baruch Hu makes a bris with the world, that he will not bring a flood, is that specifically referring only to water? Or is there a bris that Hashem will not allow the world become totally destroyed? It seems from this explanation that the bris is understood that in spite of all the things we do, all the averus we do, in spite of nuclear war, in spite of all the things we invent, Hashem will not allow us to destroy this world. That there will always be something that will be left over. That the Mabul was the last time that there was an evil without the world and without destruction. So, yeah, there might be individuals. Yeah, but we're talking about the world itself reaching a level where there's no and the cloud. It's interesting, therefore, that one of the lessons of the Mabul, in effect, is a diminution, a reduction in the power of the human being. And there's an effect. The human being is B'Tzelem Elokim, all powerful. In fact, Hashem basically said, our capacity to do damage to the world has been diminished. But that also means that our capacity, the cloud, has been diminished. That's why before the Mabul, people lived, 900 years and everything else. In other words, we've become very, very diminished in a lot of ways. In fact, it even makes the point, I don't want to the Sfarim make the point, that before the Mabul, it says Adam was the ruler of all the creatures. After the Mabul, the only thing Hashem told Noah was, the animals will be afraid of you. Now, that's very different. The idea of afraid of you basically is that even wild animals try to avoid people. Not always, but they try to avoid people. But you can't give them an order. Before the Mabul, you could order the lion to come to you and eat out of your hands and everything else. Afterwards, Hashem says, they'll be afraid of you, they'll avoid you, they won't hurt you unless you provoke them, but they're no longer within your shlita. In other words, that's part of, in order that you cannot affect the Bria to that same extent. By the way, the Gemara says a striking thing. The Gemara says, because of this pasuk that animals are afraid of human beings, no animal attacks a human being unless the human being looks like a human. Because of our averos, the animal does not see us as a human being. But a human being is B'Tzelem Elokim. So when an animal looks at a human being, the animal has a natural fear. Because we were not in that animal's vision. In a way, the animal has a truer perception of our essence of human beings. That's why when the animals don't attack tzaddikim, it's not so much of a mace, it's the animal sees what the tzaddik is, and the mela. Marachan chitcha via, I'll write this here, we all call chayas.
Okay. Yeah, but what are
you
saying
in the
Zephyr when you see a rainbow? If this is an expression of Hashem's unhappiness with us, when we see a rainbow, what exactly is
about? No, because the praise is how compassionate is the Ribbono Shel Olam, that even at a time when we're not so deserving, he remembers his bris and will not destroy us. I believe anywhere in the world.
Now, of course, the Rishonim asked the question, the Rishonim already asked the question, that if a rainbow is a natural phenomenon, right? A rainbow is you have moisture in the air, and sunlight strikes water drops, so it breaks into a prism, just like, you know, when you have a gasoline puddle, right? You see a rainbow, you see a gasoline puddle. So the question is, presumably, rainbows existed before the flood as well. That's the natural phenomenon of light. So how could we now say the rainbow means anything if the rainbow exists with Derech HaTeva? I think they give different answers. They actually talk about the fact that the composition of the atmosphere may have been different before the flood, so naturally you didn't have the moisture that would break up, you know. But be it as it may, Torah clearly is made that even if rainbows have scientific causes, when Hashem created that particular cause and effect relationship to convey a symbol. In other words, the fact that something is a scientific principle does not negate the fact that Hashem may have created that scientific reality to represent a spiritual truth. That's his takyokyo raisu borei alma, that Hashem looks at the spiritual needs of the world, and the laws of physics are structured to reflect the spiritual reality. So it's not really a contradiction.
Going back to this idea, the rainbows often occur, I mean sometimes occur for just a small segment of a population or even a place, and they're not even seen or visible. You think that if you're going to make something that's going to be a sign for people, you should see it.
Yeah, well, again, as I say, it might be, you know, it's very hard to be that localized about it, but it might be that if there's a rainbow in a certain neighborhood, there's a sign for that neighborhood. You know? Yeah. Whoever sees it, it's supposed to be... Well, it's not really said. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's... It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's compassion and love. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that although this is a generation that may not be so deserving, but I love them anyway, and I promise to take care of them.
So a generation, not a specific, like this month there was a huge rainbow, that means this month there's been some particular event?
Yeah, that I don't know. I don't know if we have to tie it into a specific day or a specific month. But when it's seen, that means the generation at some point was not seen. So it may not be limited to the place or even the particular time. That we're not sure of. The one thing the Gemara tells us is that if a person's in the tzaddik's lifetime, the keshes was not seen, that's a sign of the great tzaddik of the next generation.
So if it's there is an inyan to not looking at a rainbow?
Some have an inyan. I mean, we're not, you know, most people are not machmir. But some say you shouldn't stare at the rainbow because it's a revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's promise in the Torah.
Oh. But if you know that there's a rainbow, you can look at it long enough to make a bracha.
Oh, yeah,
you
sure.
Can go and get
the
bracha.
You have to look at it, sure. You have to look at it.
But, and do people, like I was even told that if you know that there's a rainbow outside, but if you haven't seen it, you don't have to go out to look at it in order to make the bracha.
You're not mechuyah, you're not obligated, but you're certainly permitted. Uh-huh. And I don't see any reason why it would not be permitted. Now, I recall seeing, really in my life, only one...
There was one on Sunday, the day after the parsha.
I was in Chicago, I guess, like tremendous rainbow.
This huge rainbow from one side to the other.
It's very, very rare.
Really?
What?
Yeah. We had people driving by to tell us it's at parsha. It was the day after parsha.
Wow.
It was the day after parsha.
Well, I can't give you a definitive
information. No, the whole sound was interesting.